Good evening. I am Alan Gervey, and this is Gervey's Law. Hope you all have had a great weekend. I certainly have, and I came into the studio this evening. And typically the first thing I do when I come into the studio is talk to our engineer and say, Wayman, hey, we need some music for the show. And it's not always easy. The last few weeks we had Alan Dershowitz on and Congressman Jamie Raskin, Jerry Springer, NSA, former NSA Director Robert O'Brien. How do you come up with music for the bumpers where we come in and out of the commercials? How do you come up with music for these people? So today I walk in and I say, Wayman, we got it easy today. Actually, it's not that easy because we have like 100 choices for the bump music for today's show. And so, yeah, it's tough to pick the best ones because there's so much to choose from. I want to introduce to you now the reason why we have so much music to choose from in this episode of Gervey's Law. He is a rock and roll legend, guitarist, singer, and songwriter. He's the founding member of two iconic bands, the Guess Who and Backman Turner Overdrive. And I did say Backman Turner Overdrive because I walk in here and all the people who work here, they're all saying, oh, wow, you've got Randy Bachman. You got Randy Bachman. And I'm like, it's Backman. It's not Bachman. It's like, it's drama. It's not drama. It's drama. But, you know, I have to give you a full disclaimer here. I am originally from Winnipeg, the hometown of Randy Bachman, and I do say Dram and I do say Bachman, but if you want to say Bachman, I don't think he cares. He's such a good guy that you can call him anything you want. He's also recorded as a solo artist. He's been a national radio personality in Canada on CBC Radio for so many years. Since 2005, he's hosted the musical show Vinyl Tap, which is CBC's top-rated show for about 16 years. In 2016, he was inducted into the Musicians Hall of Fame and Museum in Nashville. And he has the distinction of hitting number one in the United States with two different Canadian bands. Not many people can say that. The Guess Who with American Woman and BTO, Backman Turner Overdrive, with You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. And it is such an honor and pleasure to welcome the legend to Gervey's Law. Welcome to Gervey's Law, Randy Bachman.
Hey, thank you. I thought when you said Bachman, I thought this guy must be from Winnipeg. And then you said you were from Winnipeg. Wow.
Isn't that funny? Yeah, it's a long time. I haven't been there. But, you know, you are a great storyteller, and you're known as one of the best. When you tell stories, everyone listens. I got it. Tell you one story because it has been haunting me for so many years. Many years ago, when I was at a high school dance, it was Grand Park High School, not the high school you went to, or should I say, not the high school that you got kicked out of, West Kildonan Collegiate, finishing. And that's another story. So I'm at Grand Park High School. We have this dance, and the song that's playing on the dance floor is You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. And I'm looking across the floor, and I see this girl. I've never seen her before. She's at the dance. She's wearing these jeans, and I can see them right now with no pockets on them. They're just all jean, no pocket, no nothing. And when the song plays, and maybe, Wayman, you can play it, I'm going to tell you what she does. Bonk, bonk. All right, so when the bonk, bonk parts on You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, her hips go so fast to the right, and then on the next bump, ma, they go to the left. And for, like, the last 40 years, all I've been doing is seeing in my dreams every night those hips. I don't know who she was. I have no idea, but I hear that bump, bump with the hips going violently to one side or the other. Now, Randy, I'm sure that's not the only story that you've heard about your music and how it's impacted so many people. What does it feel like to think that so many people around the world have been impacted by the music you started when you won a singing contest on CKY at 3 years old?
Well, it's quite dreamlike. I'm still in the dream. You know, as a kid, you sing music, you play music. As a teenager, you start a band, and all you want to do is get one song on the radio, and then 30 years later, you're driving along, you hear many of your songs on the radio, and you look at the people next to you in the cars, and they're banging the steering wheel, the dash to your song, and they're singing and they're dancing. And it's really surreal. It's really quite amazing.
You know, when you think about it, people in this country don't realize that you're Canadian. A lot of them, you know, if I mention Backman Turner Overdrive or Guess Who, and you start talking about some of the songs, Taking Care of Business, American Woman, You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, These Eyes, Laughing, Let It Ride, No Sugar Tonight, Undone, Share the Land, Clap for the Wolfman, No Time, and it goes on and on and on, and people are shocked. They go, really? That's Canadian? And that wasn't how it was intended. Back in the 60s when you started out and you were in London meeting all of these people with no money, how did it evolve into something that became so, dare I say, Americanized?
Well, we always came home to Winnipeg. Because, you know, that's where Mama's cooking was, and she also did your laundry, and all your buddies were there. But we basically spent all of our time touring the United States, the USA. And, you know, in those days, there was no MTV, there was no national radio, there's no satellite or anything. If a station in L.A. was playing your record, you went to L.A. Then you drove to San Diego. Then you drove to Dallas. Then you drove to Boston. Wherever you were getting airplay, you went and played a club or a concert in that area to perpetuate the airplay, meet the DJs, be friends. So when the next record came out, they would know who you were. And I'm telling you, when the Guess Who and BTO, we would basically do 300 gigs a year.
Wow.
You know, 2 and 3 years in a row, we would get home for a weekend a month. 2 or 3 days every month. Consequently, it destroys your marriage and your home life and everything, but that's the choice that every person you see in the road or go see at a concert, this is what's happening to them. When the concert is over, they are usually alone in their hotel room trying to get 2 or 3 hours sleep because they've got to get up early in the morning and leave for the next gig, and everyone else goes home with their loved one. They're all snuggled in bed. They're all having a drink by the fireside or snuggling up or whatever, and you are alone with your guitar or your drum or your piano. That's the reality of the show, rock and roll business.
But it's something for you that's different because you've maintained such strong family values through it all. Even though you experienced all of the above, and I know there's stories where you looked out for people when maybe you thought they were doing some drugs and stuff and you were checking them out. I love the story about when you talk about getting stretched and, you know, just tell us quickly, but I want to ask you, Randy, how did you maintain that kind of family? Your son, Tal, of course, is a great musician in his own right. She's So High. A lot of Americans know the song She's So High. And, you know, you were close with your mother, used to listen to Beefs and Bouquets in the morning on CJOB together.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How did you do it through all this, maintained this kind of strong family values?
Hard to say. Well, you grew up in Winnipeg, and so you know what that's like. It's a very family-oriented town. You grow up, you got your little pod, you got your brothers and sisters or your cousins. You're all Jewish, or you're all Italian, or you're all German, or you're all British or Scottish, or whatever. And you have this little pod of people that you kind of grow up in, and there's a comfort and safety there. And then you start to play baseball, Little League baseball, against the guys from Grand Park or River Heights Community Center, and I'm in West Kelowna. And then you start to play hockey. And then you're thinking, why are we playing hockey? It's minus 40 below and there's no indoor rinks. Let's start a band, and then our band will play your community center, and then Neil Young and the Squires will come and play our community center, and we'll have, like, the bands will be playing. We'll still be against each other, but as friends, and we'll be in bands. And out of that 60s, a temperament and environment in Winnipeg, out came the Guess Who, Neil Young, you know, who went into, you know, Buffalo Springfield and Backman and Turner Overdrive. We all kind of came out of that we were all high school friends there. We were 14, 15, or 16. We would loan amplifiers and guitars to each other and trade songs and help each other out and see each other on the bus. Nobody had cars. Our parents didn't even have cars. I would get on the bus in my end of town with a little amp and a guitar. Two stops later, our drummer, Gary Peterson, would get on with a drum set and come to the back of the bus. And if we got to the gig that night, hopefully we had a friend there that might have had a car. Our parents picked them up to take us home because we had no way to get home. We just wanted to rock and roll. And so you want to go back to that. You want to go home to mama's cooking. You want to go home to grandma's cooking. And there's a comfort. On the road, there is no comfort. Every day is Russian roulette when you eat at a restaurant. You have no idea of the cleanliness or if you're going to get food poisoning or whatever. And you have no idea who's driving your car or airplane. So many things can go wrong on the road. And I usually try to compare this, say, to people, when you go on a vacation with your family, no matter if you're a kid or if you're the parent and you're taking your kids, some days everything goes wrong. It rains. You're in a tent. It's raining. You get sick. Somebody gets sick. You go home. On the road, that happens every single day when you're a musician traveling. Somebody gets sick somewhere. Someone has paid $100 to see you play, and they want you to go out on stage and play 100% perfect and hit every note perfect, and you've got a sore back, and you can't sleep, and you know what I mean? You're coughing, and you can't stand up straight, and you ache all over, and you go out and you give 100% of your performance, and that's showbiz.
But, you know, that's you. That's not everyone. And, you know, when you talk about your circle of friends, I didn't have a circle of friends that included the likes of Gary Peterson, Chad Allen, Neil Young, or Fred Turner, and later Burton Cummings. You know, I was at River Heights playing hockey with kids who, you know, had snot coming from their nose, and it was freezing, and no one was playing music, but you still managed to maintain that kind of down-to-earth feeling, and maybe it was the relationships that you had with your family. You know, you talk about listening to Beeson Bouquets every morning, which was a show on CJOB. I think it was with Red Alex or someone like that. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Was it Red Alex?
Red Alex was 7:45 to 8 o'clock. And then my mother would listen to that. Then I'd switch to CKY, which was like rock and roll, or CKRC, which was rock and roll.
You know, but you got to tell the story, because this is a great story. When you're listening with your mom and someone calls and talks about Neil Young and the Squires, and you're like, oh, man, he's got some fans already, and they're calling Beeson Bouquets. They want to give him a bouquet. And what does your mom say?
Well, I just said to her, listen to this guy, Neil Young. He must be incredible. I mean, they keep phoning in saying they saw him play at River Heights Community Center or wherever on the weekend. This guy's got a fan club. And my mother says, that's Rassi, his mother. I know her voice. She's on television. And I said, what? That's his mother phoning in saying how great he is. So I got my mother to phone in the next Monday and say she saw me. I mean, when somebody's on the radio, you don't know how old they are. They could be 16 or 30, you know.
Right.
Saying she saw Randy Bachman play with the Guess Who, and they were great. And then I told Burton, and Burton's mother, Rhoda Cummings, she'd phone the radio station and say, oh, I saw this cute guy, Burton Cummings, playing piano. He sings just like Eric Burden and the Animals. And so all of our mothers were phoning in this Beeson Bouquets, and then sooner or later, Red Alex and the DJs figured it out and wouldn't put their calls on the air.
That's hilarious. Well, we've got to take a break. We've got a lot to talk to Randy Bachman about, not only the good old days, but coming right up to the present. He hasn't stopped. The energy is incredible. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. And it's not often I get to say that when I hear that song, but I can say that we are speaking with the person who wrote American Woman, Randy Bachman, and it became a huge hit. And then, of course, it's been covered on Lenny Kravitz has a version that a lot of people like. But take us back, Randy, to when you did American Woman with the Guess Who. And there was a little controversy and maybe some criticism from the U.S. for some of the lyrics. Did that bother you, or how did you handle it?
No, it was, we were so busy, we didn't know what was going on. I mean, when you're on the road doing, you know, 250, 300 gigs a year, you're just looking to pay the rent and the gas bill at the end of the month and keep going. We weren't even aware of our songs on the radio, because you, like I said, you'd be driving all the time and trying to get your song on the radio station, and then suddenly it's everywhere. And we had such a string of hits in such a short period of time to have These Eyes, then Laughing Undone, double A-side, and then No Time, then No Sugar Tonight, in no time, and then American Woman, all in like the span of 2 years, radio just started to play everything automatically that we would put out. We had a certain brand already, you know, with Burton's voice and my guitar playing and stuff, so they would just automatically play it. So when they automatically started to play American Woman, this is late 69 into 1970, when it hit number one in 1970, they realized there's lines in there that say, we don't want your war machine, we don't want your ghetto scenes. And suddenly somebody says, oh, is this an anti-war song? We shouldn't be playing it. You know, we should be playing Fighting Men of the Green Beret, the Barry Sandler thing. But by then it was too late. It was the number one record. And so it was kind of you know what it's like. You're a Canadian guy, and you see, we would go into a town in the USA, and you name any town, Minneapolis, Fargo, Cedar Rapids, 67, 68, 69, we would be the only guys in that town between 18 and 30. Everyone else was drafted. There was no men in late teenage through their 20s. They were all drafted and gone to Vietnam. And so we'd go into a town, and our whole audience would be all girls. Our young guys below 18, our guys over 35, there was just none there. And so this really bothered us. And the American Woman were after us all the time. We came home to this one gig in Canada with no American Women bothering us. And I broke a string. I was tuning it up on stage to start to play that riff. Dun, 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 dun. And the whole band started to play it. And then Burton came on stage and I said, sing something, sing anything. And he sang, American Woman, Stay Away From Me. He was glad to be back in Canada with Canadian women who just treated us like a normal guy and not like we were a rare species of a man, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that song just was written on stage. And then we recorded it a couple of months later and boom, it went to number one.
That's amazing. I mean, I can only imagine. But you make such a great point when you talk about how you were so focused on your music and there was so much going on that maybe you didn't have time to get caught up in whatever other people were getting caught up in. And, you know, when you talk about how you were able to put song after song and hit after hit out, you've said that you've had what you called the phonographic memory, something that allowed you to hear something once and then to be able to play it. That's a special talent. A lot of people can't even consider what that's like. Was that something that allowed you to go from hit to hit and to be able to play these songs without really reading music? And I'm not going to test you here because I know, you know, you've said in the past that you had to say that you could read music, but maybe not so much.
No, I can't read music at all.
You know, you're talking to a lawyer here. I could use that against you.
You can. Freely, and I will freely admit it. I will not take the fifth on that. No, I could look at a staff of music and go, oh, it's EGBDF, and that's on the second space, so that's an A, it's F-A-C-E. So that's an A note. Now, where is an A on the guitar? Oh, it's the second string. That takes like a minute. How do you play a song figuring out every note for like 20 or 30 seconds? So you learn to hear something once, maybe twice, and it's locked in your head. But the thing is, I started playing classical violin when I was 5. Burton Cummings started playing classical piano when he was 6. Gary Peterson started drums when he was 3. We all could read music. By the time we hit teenagehood, 14, 15, and saw Elvis and then later saw the Beatles and said, wow, you can get paid for this. You can make a living doing this. And we started a band. We didn't have to learn our instruments. We knew everything. We had grade 9 and grade 10 and grade 12 piano and guitar and everything just playing. And we would hear a record and copy it and go, great, we've got that one. Here's a set list of 50 songs and go and play a dance. I'm now touring with Burton Cummings. I just played last weekend in Grand Forks, B.C. We had 12,000 people outside. Everybody was great. Nobody had masks. Everybody was free to be outside. We played 32 hit songs in 2 hours, and the audience sang every single word. And it's so fabulous to be there celebrating the Guess Who, BTO, Burton's solo, and my solo stuff all in one show. We're touring as Bachman Cummings, and it's just damn fantastic, I got to tell you.
That's amazing. How do you find the energy? Because we're going to talk about that, you know, that you do have a tour and you're going to different places, bringing a lot of people in, selling out. And you guys, I mean, in good shape, but it's not like you're 30 years old and you're doing all of these classes. 32 songs is and I saw that hit list. It's a great list. I don't know who put it together, but between the two of you, You got them all. You got the great songs.
Well, I said to Burton the other night, this is just two nights ago, do you know that we leave out 9 songs? He said, what do you mean? I said, we have no room for Glamour Boy or Sour Sweet or Four Wheel Drive, you know, one of my BTO songs. We're leaving out like 2 or 3 of mine and 3 or 4 Guess Who songs. He said, well, we can't do them all. There's a lot of these things have a curfew. You got to be done at 11:45 or 11:30, or they pull out the plug anyways, and suddenly you're shut off. So you try to modify your show to fit that.
You know, you've had a long history with Burton, and when you say that now, is it a different kind of relationship than it was back then, where you had your ups and downs? Obviously, you were younger and there was a lot going on. Is it easier to deal with the two of you when you're saying, you know, what are we going to include and what are we not? Or is it still you just want to go after him and say, come on, Burton, you got to do it my way?
No, we both have a deep love and respect for each other and where we came from, and how that when we got together, he was like about 16 or 17. I was 2 years older than him, and I was kind of his mentor, or his older brother. And we started writing songs together to be like Lennon and McCartney and Jagger and Richards and Brian Wilson and Bacharach and David. I mean, These Eyes was really a Bacharach and David kind of song. And, you know, and then No Time is like Stephen Stills and Neil Young. It's like a Buffalo Springfield song. And a couple of other songs were kind of like the Beatles. And we just tried to copy all the great songwriters and then put our own stamp on it, which is his voice and my guitar playing. And that would kind of make it us. And we were interviewed a little while ago because we're all back together now doing this tour, which has been delayed. It's been sold out for 2 years, but it's been delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed, and nobody cashed in their tickets. So now we're playing concerts that was set up 2 years ago. And I said, you know, I said to Burton, I'm amazed and I'm really proud at what we did together and what I did on my own and what you did on your own. And here we are back together and celebrating our together and our loans, and we're back together again. You've written such incredible hit songs. And he looked at me and he just laughed. He said, and so have you. And I said, and so have we together. And so you look at the set list, and, you know, it could be 30 or 40 songs. I just saw a write-up on John Fogerty, who played the
Hollywood Bowl
in L.A. at the Hollywood Bowl. Yeah. Thing. He's like the Beatles of America. And basically, I have the same kind of cred as that, and so does Burton Cummings. We to have 20 or 30 hit songs that were all monsters from 68 to maybe 75, and then they're still on the radio. They're still alive. They're in movies and television everywhere. I just put on the television on Fox TV, and You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet is now an Applebee's commercial. I mean, when I heard that, I was stunned. I mean, you don't know when your songs are going to be used. They just get used.
And in the movie Invincible with Mark Wahlberg, BTO is all over the place in that movie. They've adapted.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you got to check it out. It's great. You know, you've got some grandchildren. I know that. They may enjoy it. I have kids who are 8 and 9 years old. They loved it. They loved the music. They were reintroduced to it. And, you know, I know you've done so much great work for schools, the Frank Hobbs School fundraiser, building a new playground for Tal's kids and some of others that went through it. So clearly you are there. You got your values in the right place. And I will tell you, you know, Fogerty, for instance, who just played the Hollywood Bowl, same kind of guy. His kid went to my kid's school last year. He put on a show for them during COVID, you know, so prolific. And he has his kids involved in his band out in his backyard. And you've had your kids involved, especially yeah. Tal. Tell us about that special music relationship.
Well, it's really something. You grow up and, you know, you've got a daughter and she might be 6 or 7, or she might be 3 or 4, and you're pushing her in a cart through the grocery aisle. This happens, oh my goodness. And when they see something on the shelf, they sing the commercial that they've heard on television and go, well, she can sing pretty well. She's only 2 or she's only 3. And then it's like Tal becomes 3 and I'm practicing, rehearsing BTO, and he sits on my brother's drums and he starts banging the drums. And I go, oh, not bad drumming for a 3-year-old kid. You know, it's just in him. And then when COVID shut us down, we started doing Friday night YouTubes. Every Saturday night, we called it the train wreck because we surprised each other. It was like a bad Wayne's World. He would show up with 5 songs, and I would try to play them with him, and I wouldn't know his songs, and he wouldn't tell me ahead of time. And I'd show up with 5 or 6 songs, and he would try to play mine, and we'd start them in the wrong key and play the wrong chords, and it was a train wreck. And we start to get email from people saying they loved it because they knew that everything they hear on the radio, we've sung it 20 times, played the solo 20 times, and put together the best of it, song on the radio. To actually see professional musicians who they thought were, you know, godlike and very great, making mistakes and stumbling and playing wrong chords, they just loved this. And out of that came our new album, the Backman album. And in the middle of one of our live YouTubes, up came this little thing at the side and said, I found your lost guitar. And my Gretsch guitar had been stolen in 1970.
Wait, hold on, Randy. This is too important. We got to take a break. Okay. That's what we call a cliffhanger. A cliffhanger. Okay. Randy Backman has just told our audience his guitar, the 1957 Gretsch 6120 Chet Atkins guitar, was stolen out of Toronto. Stay tuned. After the break, you are going to hear an incredible story that you don't want to miss. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. There you go. One of my favorites. There have been so many comments about the music of the Guess Who and BTO not being anything like music today. I was just looking at something the other day and someone commented, I think this was on No Sugar Tonight. He said, after long deliberation, thousands of songs reviewed, I've had to declare that this is the quintessential rock song of its generation. It's perfect in every way. Guitar, drums, bass, vocals, composition, creativity, execution, classic and timeless. That really sums up a lot of the Guess Who and BTO music. And we're gonna talk about the guitar in a second, but Randy Backman, comment on that.
Amazing. Who wrote that? My press agent?
No, it's your mother. No, I'm. It's a guy named Michael Irie, I-R-E-Y. And apparently he's a music historian, and he's gone through thousands of songs, like he said, and just really appreciated the underlying music and the blends and you know, all of the composition that you just don't see in today's music.
Right. I just, 2 hours ago, I was talking to a friend of mine, DJ, in New York City, and he said the same thing. He said, kids now are getting sick of everything that's on a computer that all sounds the same, all the voices are auto-tuned, everybody sounds like everybody else, even country music now, you put it on, you can't tell one band from the other, but put on classic rock, everybody has their own sound, the Doobies, Frampton, BTO, you know, Earth, Wind, and Fire, you put that on, everybody's got their own sound, and the concerts are coming alive. My friends right now are in Toronto going to see Santana and Earth, Wind, and Fire tonight. Can you imagine that show? It's got to be amazing.
Wow. Yeah, and that's...
Real people playing real music, making real mistakes. All the people want to hear now is a mistake, for Pete's sake. They want to hear something human, right?
Right. And also, in listening to that, you also hear such nuances that you can't hear in today's music. Can people still see your tour? Because I know you have some dates left, and you've been selling out. How can people, listening to this, because I just got a call that's saying, I want to see Randy Backman and Burton Cummins. How do I do it?
Well, we have a few gigs left. We are playing. We are closing the summer on September the 3rd in Vancouver. It's the PNE, the Pacific National Exhibition, which is like the Toronto National Exhibition that's going on now, the CNE, and then the Calgary Stampede and Klondike Days. They're going all over Canada. This is ending the summer on the last Saturday of the summer because on the Tuesday everyone goes back to school and work. So September the 3rd, we're headlining the Grandstand Show at the PNE. It's being filmed as part of my guitar saga that's being a rockumentary now, being filmed like for Netflix and things like that for television on my lost guitar. And that's where Backman and Cummins will be playing. And then you've got to check our website. Just go to BACHMAN-Cummins or Randy Backman. And my calendar's there. I'm either playing with my band. And then 2 weeks later, my band and I are flying to St. John's, Newfoundland and playing with the new Nancy Wilson band with your guest guitar players, and we're doing a rock show there. Then I come home and tour with Cummins again. So I am totally rocking in the free world like I've never done before.
That's amazing. And okay, that was a great segue. I really appreciate it. You work well with me here. You mentioned the lost guitar, and that's how we left it before the break. We had the cliffhanger. You got to tell us this amazing story and the fact that now we're going to get to see a documentary about it.
How much time do you have?
We're going to defer to you on this.
Okay. As a teenager, I'm 18 or 19, I see these guitars on television. Of course, they're black and white. Everything was black and white then.
Yeah.
Elvis, American Bandstand. But I see Duane Eddy playing Rebel Rouser. He's playing this guitar. I like the look of the guitar. I see Chuck Berry playing it. I see Eddie Cochran playing it. I see Chet Atkins playing it on Louisiana Hayride, which they had played a little clip on CBC television in Canada. And I'm dying to get this guitar. And one of them comes into Winnipeg, and you know this, on Portage Avenue, Winnipeg Piano or Winnipeg Musical Supply right there on Portage Avenue. And in the window is this guitar. And Neil Young called me up and said, the guitar Duane Eddy was playing in Eddie Cochran, it's pumpkin orange. You got to come and see it. So I take a bus downtown. We go and stand there, and we look in the window at this beautiful, bright orange guitar, brilliant pumpkin orange, just amazing. And it has DeArmond pickup. Then another one comes in, and I save up all my money, and I go and buy one, the one with the black pickups. Neil Young buys the other one. He still has his.
Wow.
I then take mine. I write all my songs with Burton Cummings on his grandmother's house on Bannerman in the north end of Winnipeg in West Kilbonan. And we write all our songs. I play all the songs on it. I leave the Guess Who in 1970. All the BTO stuff, what you heard, Let It Ride, that's all that guitar. And Taking Care of Business is all that guitar. And then I like that guitar so much. When I traveled, I never let anyone handle it. I carried 12 feet of chain and two locks, and I would take my guitar in a hotel into the bathroom and chain it to the toilet. Like, go through the handle around the case. So if somebody wanted to steal that, they had to rip the toilet out of the wall. And if I couldn't get it around the toilet, I would go to the television, which usually have anchored to the floor on a pedestal or to the counter, and I would chain it to that so they'd have to rip the whole piece of furniture out. And I did this for years, and everybody laughed at me, but no one ever stole the guitar. We finished recording in 1977 in Toronto at the Phase One Studios. We're there all night mixing the album. Our road manager says, I'm going to go check out of the hotel, get all our suitcases, and we'll drive home to Winnipeg because we were in Toronto. Okay. He takes my guitar. He said, I'll take your guitar.
I noticed how you took a breath, Randy, because here comes the emotional part, and you're still feeling it. I mean, that guitar was part of you, was your heart, and you had to take a breath before you tell the rest of the story.
You notice that? Wow. So he comes in, he says, your guitar is gone. We're in the studio. And I say, yeah, I know it's gone. You just took it. He said, no, I mean it's gone. I said, what do you mean it's gone? It's gone from the hotel room. What? It's gone. I'm sorry. That's all he ever said.
Wow.
And so I called the police. I had it insured. The OPP, Ontario Provincial Police, and Mounties couldn't find the guitar. It was gone. I searched for it for 40 years. And finally gave up. And in that search, everybody knew I was looking for my Gretsch guitar. There was no internet then. So I would cross the border and go to a little border town in the States. And in the States, like in below Vancouver, you'd go to Blaine, Washington, right?
Yeah.
And you'd go into the Blaine Library, and they have yellow pages of every little town in the USA. There's a library that had phone books. And so I would like look up all the vintage guitar players or stores and music stores. Say, do you have this orange Gretsch that is this serial number, blah, blah, blah. And they would call me back. Here's my phone number. And nobody had them. But I ended up buying Gretsches. My midlife crisis was buying Gretsch guitars. I ended up buying over 300 Gretsch guitars.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I read somewhere 300, and I thought, that's got to be an exaggeration. No.
No, it was actually about 350. And then in the 90s, and then they put out a Gretsch book. And I sent some of my pictures into this Gretsch book written by Jay Scott. And then I got a call, which amazed me, from Fred Gretsch. Okay, the grandson of the original Friedrich Gretsch, who started Gretsch Guitars in the early 1900s in New York, in Brooklyn, New York. And he says, I hear you have this many guitars. And I say, yes. And he said, can I come and see them? And I said, sure. So he came from Savannah, Georgia, all the way to White Rock, B.C., where I lived. And he brought Pete from Pete's Rare Guitars in Minneapolis to look at the guitars with him. And he also brought a guy named Duke Kramer, who was the head of Gretsch Guitars. And he said, I lost the name Gretsch Guitars years ago in a corporate buyout, but I've just got it back. So now I can make and sell Gretsch Guitars. But the factory burnt down, and we don't have any templates anymore. You have 300
Gretsch. Yeah, you have the inventory right there.
Right. Can we borrow your guitars, five or six at a time, and copy them to make the new Gretsch Guitars? And I said, sure, of course, great, I'm thrilled. So every Gretsch guitar you see now, anywhere in a store, anybody playing it, that's from 1990 on, is a copy of the one I had in my collection.
Amazing.
He actively copied it. Then he came to me 3 years later and he said, Fender has a museum, Gibson has a museum, Martin Guitars have a museum, you have my museum, I want to buy all your guitars. And I said, great, I want to buy a flat in Covent Garden in England, because I've been trying to buy one since 1967, since Burton Cummings, and I went there in the Guess Who. Now, you buy my guitars. By the way, I tripled the money I had, you know, by selling them to Fred Gretsch and what I invested in him over three decades.
I can imagine.
I bought this great flat in Covent Garden, right downtown in London, and it was absolutely fantastic. And so now all my guitars are in the Gretsch Museum in Savannah, Georgia.
That's amazing. And now we only have a minute before we have to take a break, and we can carry on because it's a great story, but let's get to Japan.
Well, let me give you the cliffhanger, okay?
Yeah, I'm ready for it.
I'm doing the YouTubes with my son, Tal, and when you do a live YouTube, at the side of the screen there's a little black space, and the people write in comments, nice shoes, lousy pants, good song, great mistake, things like that. And one pops up and says, I found your lost guitar.
Wait a second. Well, you didn't believe that for a second when you saw that.
No, I didn't. And I said, Tal said, this guy sent me one before. He's in White Rock. He lives two blocks from where we used to live in White Rock. And I say, okay, call this guy. I have a feeling about this guy. So Tal calls this guy William Long, and you won't believe what happened next. And there's your cliffhanger.
There's the cliffhanger. We got to take a break. That's a great cliffhanger. You're doing this better than I am, Brandy. All right.
Great.
Stay tuned. You got to come back and hear the rest of the story. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here. Yeah, we're taking care of business today with Randy Backman. I'll tell you, we don't do music often on Gervie's Law, but when we do, we knock it out of the park. And the music has been really, really amazing on this show. And I have to say, probably the best of the whole year, with all due respect to Paul Anka, who we had on the show a few months back, and he had some great music that we played, but this is really rocking us out. Randy, you got to tell us. Everyone's waiting to hear, and there's going to be a documentary. I don't know if you know when that documentary is going to be ready, but I know a lot of people want to see it. You're filming it now, but let's hear the end of the story and let us know when everyone can watch that documentary.
Okay, so we contact William Long, he's a guy in White Rock, and he says, I found the BTO YouTube of you doing Looking Out for Number One, which is a song from that last album that I played the guitar on. And I froze the picture of you playing the guitar, and then I Googled every orange Gretsch guitar sold, and that picture might be on the internet in the last 15 years, and I found your guitar.
No.
And a guy's named Takeshi, and he's playing Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree in Tokyo Nightclub last Christmas. This is 2 years ago in Christmas. And here's Takeshi, and I look at it, and it's my guitar, and I can't breathe, I can't move, I am frozen. I am in tears. This guy has my guitar. Wow. And then William Long says, but I can't contact him because he doesn't speak English and I don't speak Japanese. My son Tal's partner is Eriko Yamamoto. She's from Japan. So she gets on the internet and calls, gets a hold of Takeshi and his manager, who do not speak English, sets up a Zoom. Takeshi comes on and shows me the guitar. And through Eriko asking him, how did he get it? He said, I went into a store, music store, and a vintage guitar store in Tokyo to buy a Les Paul or a Strat like Hendrix or a Strat or a Les Paul like Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
And I didn't like them. And on the way out, I saw this orange guitar on the wall, and it spoke to me. And it said to me, I am special. Take me home. I exist in houses and hearts and minds of millions of people all over the world. Take me home. And he said, so I bought the guitar and took it home 7 years ago.
Wow.
And now I find out it's your guitar, and that's amazing. And now I know I'm an honest man. I'll give you back your guitar, but you must find its twin. What do you mean? I said, I'll give you a brand new Gretsch guitar. He said, I don't want a brand new Gretsch. It must be a 1957 Gretsch with DeArmond pickups with no repairs, no modifications, nothing. So this is like a caveat for me to find. So I say, okay, give me a day. Luckily, in one phone call, I phoned a friend of mine, Gary, at Gary's Vintage Guitars in Loveland, Ohio, saying, hey, Gary, you know, this is Randy Backman. I bought a bunch of Gretsches from you over the years. And he said, yeah. I said, I think I found mine. I need its twin sister. And he said, I've got about four or five in the store. Let me check them over. So he called me a few days later, and he said, I found a 1957. The serial number is this, blah, 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 blah. And I go, wow, that's two off of mine.
Wow.
So it was made in the same week. It's from the same litter. It's like getting, you know, a puppy from the same litter. When your dog's been run over, you go and get a puppy from the same litter. And I show it to Takeshi on the next Zoom, and he says, yes, I'll trade that guitar. And this is like a year ago. And I say, okay, send it to me, and I'll send you this one. He said, no, no, no. you must come and get it. I will not put this on a plane, and you can't put the sister on a plane. So I have this brother, this guitar brother, this brotherhood who I can't even talk to. I would need Erica there to translate for me. And now we have the twin sisters. And out of this, out of the blue, we get an email from the Canadian ambassador in Tokyo saying, hey, I'm Ian McKay from BC, and I'm a fan of the guest. When I heard about your guitar, why don't you do your exchange on Canada Day here at the Canadian consulate in Tokyo? And go, wow, this is like the dream is not even coming true. It's becoming a better dream. I'm not waking up from the dream.
Yeah.
Amazing. So I say, okay, so we arrange this thing. It's all done through Coco being our translator, setting it all up. So we set it up at the Canadian consulate there, and they won't let me meet Takeshi. We go there 2 weeks early because it's 17-hour time difference,
yeah.
And I've got to get used to the climate and the time change. They won't even let me see my guitar or meet Takeshi until I walk on stage. So the whole thing is being filmed, and they want to see my reaction. It's like there's a knock at your door, and they say, oh, were you in Grand Beach in Winnipeg, like in 1968? And you go, yeah. And you had a girlfriend named Susan, yeah. Well, I think I'm your daughter. You know, that kind of.
Well, hopefully that didn't happen.
Rhonda, they want that kind of reaction from me, like the yeah. what? And so when it was all done on Canada Day, the Tyler Newsom, who's the producer, he's in L.A., he came and he said, we got it. And I said, go. Well, he said, we got your reaction, exactly what we wanted. When you walked on stage with Takeshi and you did the exchange, there would be no second take of that. No actor could recreate that, and we knew you couldn't. So we've got the first take. You've got your guitar back, and we've got it captured. So they're going to be filming Burton Cummings and I on September the 3rd, closing the P&E here. I'm going to hold the guitar in the air when I walk on stage, and that's what I played No Sugar Tonight and New Mother Nature on, and I also played it on Taking Care of Business. So the guitar is going to be played on the first song, put it on a stand, and I play it. The last song of the night is TCB, and I play that guitar on it, and then I'll take the guitar home. It'll be the triumphant ending of the Netflix, I guess.
I mean, that's so incredible. I mean, I'm in awe. I'm sitting here listening. I want to see it, but it's got to be a little bit nerve-wracking for you. I mean, this is the culmination of so many years. It almost encapsulates your whole career and your whole music and your love for people, for singing, for music, for guitar playing. Like, how are you looking at this? How are you approaching it? You must not be able to sleep thinking about it.
No, I am in a complete awe and amazement at me trying to find this guitar for 45 years, and then it finds me.
Unbelievable.
Takeshi had no intention of buying it. It just spoke to him. He was walking out of the store. We went and interviewed the guy there, which we need a translator for. He doesn't speak English. He had bought it 9 years before in Dallas at the guitar show. He had no intention of buying it. He went there to buy Les Pauls and white Strats like Hendrix, which everybody wants. And somebody put the guitar in the ship, and he arrived at his store. He didn't know where he got it from or anything. It was put on the wall. So this guitar, we're calling it Lost and Found, the Magic Guitar, because I wrote number one albums and it and sold 45 million records with this guitar and wrote all the music. And so now that we've got it back, Cal and I are going to write the closing song for the rockumentary, we're calling it. It'll be called Lost and Found. It'll be playing over the closing credits. He and I we're going to be filming in a couple of weeks. They're going to come and film him and me writing the song and recording it. And we've got a new album out, Backman album. That's a really cool album that we wrote about the whole COVID and shutdown and what it did to our lives. And it's a very touching human album. It doesn't sound like BT or The Guess Who or Tal Bachman. It's a brand new album, my father and son, 50-50, playing, writing, singing. And it's quite Americana, 70s rock and roll, kind of country rock, like early Crosby, Stills and Nash or early Eagles or No Time, you know, by The Guess Who. It's kind of that really great mixture of all the music from the 60s coming out in the early 70s.
So when is that one coming out?
Well, everything should be out next year. They're getting the film ready to premiere at Sundance, Tribeca in New York, Cannes in France, and TIFF in Toronto.
Amazing.
So that'll be early next spring. It'll be coming out. Then we're going to go to Tokyo again on July the 1st, Canada Day again, and have a big release there at the movie theater downtown. It'll be shown there. So we're looking at next summer. Canada Day seems to be waving the Canadian flag for me, like, let's get this done. And you know what's amazing? We broke the internet on July the 1st. We got a call the next day saying over 80 IPP providers, or whatever it's called, your internet provider, were frozen because everybody wanted to watch the ceremony. And that hadn't happened since Donald Trump won the presidency when all the internet shut down.
And I'm sure a lot...
everybody wanted to move to Canada.
That's right. A lot more people wanted to see your guitar than Donald Trump, even though they were both orange. Let me say this, Randy. When this comes out, you've got to come back on the show. You've got to talk about it because we want to hear about the documentary. We need to have you come back and finish this story. It's been so incredible. He tweets at Randy's Vinyl Tap. Check out the Vinyl Tap. You go online, you'll find a lot on Randy Bachman and what he's doing now and all of this incredible stuff. I want to thank you so much, Randy, for being with us today. It's been amazing.
I want to thank you, and I want to say how much your roots in Winnipeg made a difference on this show.
Oh, I love it. You know, you can take the boy out of Winnipeg, but you can't take Winnipeg out of the boy.
You are right.
Randy Bachman, good luck. Enjoy the rest of the tour, and we'll be watching out for all the exciting stuff happening with you, Tal, and everyone else involved with the guitar. Thanks for listening to Gurry's Law. We'll see you next week.